22. Later, Philip, Tyler, Gary, and Jimmy all agreed that breathing in the pee steam was unpleasant, but that it had been an unnecessary embellishment, gilding the lily, if you will. Every other aspect of the weapon crafting process had been so acutely unpleasant that by the time they got to the quench, it seemed an anticlimax. They say that blacksmithing is a lost art, but Philip had begun to suspect that it wasn't lost. It had been deliberately discarded. First, the billet of Lagavulin steel needed to be heated until it glowed cherry red, which meant more pumping on the bellows. Then it needed to be flattened, which meant all four of them hammering it like mad on Inchgower's new anvil. Of course, it would begin to cool as soon as it was pulled out of the fire, so it would need to be heated up again, which meant more pumping until it was hot enough to start hammering again. After they had lathered, rinsed, and repeated enough times to lose count, the Lagavulin steel billet had transformed into a long, thin, flat blade, 3 inches wide and 12 feet long.
"Typical," Tyler said. "After all this mystery about the ultimate weapon, it's a sword. A really long sword. Todd has no imagination."
Gary said, "Yeah, but still, it's gonna be really cool when it's done." Tyler was unconvinced.
"Nobody be able to swing a blade that big."
"Not one person," Gary said. "Maybe two people use it together."
"How?" Tyler asked. "Would they each hold the handle with both hands and discuss where they want to swing the sword?"
Gary said, "No, I was thinking there'd be a handle at each end, like an old-timey lumberjack saw. We could run on either side of our enemy and cut them in half."
Inchgower donned thick protective gloves and lifted the blade over his head to look at it. He held the blade center high overhead, the end sagging to nearly waist height.
"Yes," the computer-generated blacksmith said. "It's a good blade."
"For a small helicopter, maybe," Philip muttered.
"You've all been a fine help,"
Inchgower said, oblivious to Philip's comment.
"But the time for brute force is over. Shaping and forming the blade into an object of might and power will require skill and finesse. This will take every bit of knowledge I have about the exquisite art of metalwork."
Inchgower turned his back to the wizards. He held the center of the comically oversized blade over the fire. He let go of it, and it stayed, hovering in midair. Instantly, the entire length of the blade glowed orange from the heat. Inchgower moved his hands in a vaguely work-like manner and made sounds of extreme effort. The blade glowed even more brightly. It turned so that the thin edge of the blade was perpendicular to the floor. All of the sag went out of the blade now that its thicker dimension resisted the pull of gravity. The blade bent up into a U-shape, then into a circle, seemingly of its own accord. The now circular blade spun and twisted in the air, forming the shape of an orange glowing sphere. As it gyrated in space, its free ends contorted and fused together. The spinning slowed, then stopped, leaving a glowing orange circle hovering behind Inchgower, slowly burning its way into the wizard's retinas. Inchgower grasped the burning circle and turned to face the wizards. In a voice trembling with awe, Inchgower said,
"Gentlemen, look upon what we have wrought!"
Inchgower froze, clipping the end of the word "wrought" as if he'd been startled. He placed the glowing hoop on the floor. His movements were more mechanical than usual. Tyler groaned. The blacksmith stood unnaturally straight, looked directly ahead with a blank expression, and said,
"We've purified and toughened it, but we also need it to harden. Time for the quench."
"He didn't even bother to record fresh dialogue," Tyler said. "He just grabbed the same sentence from earlier and slapped it in there."
The sound of Inchgower unzipping his fly in preparation for the quench was cartoonishly loud and out of place.
"But he went to the trouble to dig up the sound of a fly unzipping?"
Tyler whined.
"That's just great. Never mind that there's no way a Dark Ages blacksmith would even have a zipper."
Inchgower attained a state of readiness to proceed with the quench, then froze, as he tended to when waiting for the wizards to make the next move. After a profoundly uncomfortable moment, Inchgower repeated,
"Time for the quench."
Another long silence followed, and ended with the phrase,
"Time for the quench."
Philip sighed heavily, then said,
"We all know what he wants. We're not going to move on until it happens. We might as well get it over with."
The wizards reluctantly prepared themselves, then waited for a signal as to who should start the quench. When Inchgower failed to make the first move, they all took a deep breath and got on with it. The sizzling noise and the noxious cloud of steam pouring off the circular blade was actually kind of satisfying. The quench might have almost qualified as fun if Inchgower hadn't bellowed,
"Take a good deep breath, lads. You've earned it."
The wizards all continued to hold their breath, shaking their heads and humming emphatic mm-mms. Inevitably, they all ran out of steam and started to run out of air. Inchgower seemed to have an endless supply of both and repeated,
"Take a good deep breath, lads. You've earned it."
After a long, silent moment, Inchgower said,
"Take a good deep breath, lads. You've earned it."
More silence followed until Inchgower again said,
"Take a good deep breath, lads. You've earned it."
Gary was the first to give in and breathe. Because he had pushed himself to the edge of asphyxia, he took a deep, gulping breath and immediately started coughing and moaning simultaneously. Between coughs, he managed to say,
"I taste it!"
The others had been on the edge of giving in and breathing anyway. Now they were laughing and breathing and tasting and yelling and then laughing again. Todd's window winked into existence. Todd looked haggard, but quite pleased with himself.
"We had to rush to work that in, but it was totally worth it. Thanks for the idea, guys."
"You record a new dialogue about how we should take a breath. Why didn't you record a new explanation for the quench while you were at it?"
Tyler asked, indignant.
"This is an independent project that I'm bankrolling myself. Voice talent and studio time are both expensive. I ended up sending an intern with an iPhone mic to get the new lines, and he dropped the ball."
"So you just rolled with it as is?"
Tyler said.
"Typical. It's a lack of consistency and attention to detail that makes this all seem so rinky-dink."
Todd said,
"Shut up!"
and disappeared, along with his vid window. Inchgower bent in half at the waist, stooping in a manner that physics would never allow. He grasped the now fully quenched, dull metal ring. He lifted it high over his head. Gary groaned,
"Ew, it's dripping."
Inchgower resumed the triumphant posture he had held before the quench and resumed his previous speech. Tyler silently noted that he could hear the very end of the T from the word wrought, where the speech had been edited.
"We have created a weapon of power, elegance, and beauty. A weapon of such unusual and inexplicable properties that most men cannot even comprehend it. Gentlemen, I give you the Mabeus Blade."
A point of bright light started at Inchgower's gloved hand and raced around the outer edge of the dull metal ring, leaving a highly polished, razor-sharp edge in its wake. The light made a full lap of the ring's outer edge, then completed a lap of the inner circumference. The blade gleamed in the light, a perfect circle except for a single kink near the blacksmith's hand, where the blade had been twisted one half turn, creating a weaponized version of the popular grade school brain teaser, the Möbius strip.
"It is at once the simplest and most complex weapon imaginable,"
Inchgower explained.
"The blade has but one edge, but mysteriously, that edge is somehow twice the length of the blade itself."
"Just the thing if you want to kill M.C. Escher," Philip said.
Inchgower continued.
The Mobius blade is a weapon utterly refined. Anything that cannot be used to kill has been removed as dead weight.
Gary raised his hand and said,
There's no handle.
Jimmy said,
That's what he means.
It is so deadly,
Inchgower said,
that it presents a mortal danger to anyone who comes near it, even those who wield it.
As if to drive this point home, a trickle of blood ran down Inchgower's arm, emanating from his palm, where the blade had cut through his heavy gloves and then into his hand. Philip said,
Wow, that's something.
I'm glad you find it interesting, Jimmy said, because we're going to have to think of some way to carry that thing to whatever the next stop is, then presumably use it in battle.
Inchgower lowered the Mobius blade so that it hovered parallel to the floor, supported entirely by the blacksmith's powerful forearm and wrist.
Take it,
Inchgower commanded.
Take the Mobius blade. Carry it to the chasm of certain doom, and meet your destiny.
Gary muttered,
That just couldn't sound less promising.
But go with care, for it lies beyond a mighty desert known as the Scuppa. You must transport the blade through the Scuppa without damaging it. The edge is as fragile as it is deadly. You may take with you as much water as you can carry, but it will only help you ward off the thirst. It will be no protection against the sand wolves, nor the dreaded elemental that lies in your path.
Elemental? Jimmy asked. What's an elemental?
Inchgower said,
The well, as you know, is out back. Now take the blade. Your destiny awaits.
Inchgower froze, waiting for the next trigger, which suited the wizards just fine. They were in no hurry to get their hands anywhere near the Mobius blade. They took the opportunity to examine it. From a distance, the blade looked like a polished metal ring, about 4 feet across, with a single twist taking up about a quarter of its circumference. They were told that it was deadly, but from a distance, it didn't look all that menacing. When they got closer, close enough to actually touch the blade, the danger seemed like an actual physical presence. The thin, cold Lagavulin steel, whatever that meant, was honed to an edge so sharp that just looking at it made you fear that you were cutting your eyes. Every childhood memory of mishaps with kitchen knives and paper cutters was called instantly to mind. Every parental warning about scissors and gardening implements rang in their ears. Every safety film about shop equipment, every surprisingly graphic warning sticker slapped on the side of a deli slicer, it all flooded to mind, beseeching them to not get anywhere near that awful thing.
Well, we have to take the blade from him somehow, Philip said. Things aren't going to progress until we all accept it.
Jimmy said,
I say we support the blade from underneath, with our palms up. Then we bow our fingers back so we don't get them anywhere near the edges.
Edge.
Tyler corrected him.
A Mobius strip only has one edge. If you follow it with your finger, you'll see that it follows the entire outside and inside of the ring without breaking.
Sure, Jimmy said. And I'll probably cut my finger off, too. Anyway, three of us will support it with our palms. Then whoever gets the part with the twist can put their hands above it and use their fingers to pinch the sides.
Side, Tyler said. A Mobius strip only has one side, too. If you drove a Hot Wheels car along...
I don't care, Jimmy said. I just want to take it off Bluto's hands and put it down on the floor with minimal blood loss, okay?
Tyler said, Sorry, you're right. It's just that this is the first halfway cool idea Todd has had.
Philip said,
I'm sure the fact that you think so makes him very happy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll shut up.
Tyler blurted. Philip, Jimmy, and Gary placed their hands under the blade, making sure that the side of the blade rested on the meaty parts of their palms. This was the most convex part of their hands, but the blade was also perilously close to their wrists. Tyler pinched the blade from above. As soon as his fingers made contact with the blade, Inchgower let go.
Good fortune on your journey, lads,
the blacksmith said, resting his soot-covered hands on his soot-covered hips.
I've enjoyed your company, but now our time together is at an end.
He stood there, silently watching the nervous wizards holding the Mobius blade. Gary said,
I think he wants us to leave.
And we will, Philip said. Just not yet.
The blade was surprisingly light, especially when its weight was spread out across four people. It also felt utterly rigid, as if they couldn't bend it at all even if they tried, which they absolutely, categorically were not going to do. They carefully lowered it to the ground. Tyler easily let go of his portion of the blade. Then he ran around sticking rocks, chunks of wood, anything he could find under the blade so that it would be supported up off the floor and the others could get their hands out from under it without losing any skin. Inchgower repeated,
Good fortune on your journey, lads. I've enjoyed your company, but now our time together is at an end.
Great, Philip said. Now we get to listen to that every minute or so. A nice little reminder that we're no longer welcome here.
So we ignore him, Jimmy said. It'll serve as a nice little reminder to Todd that we'll move on when we're damn good and ready.
Gary scouted around the village, looking unsuccessfully for something to help them carry the blade. Unfortunately, they had dismantled their sledge and used it to stoke the fire that, ironically, had helped make the very thing they now wanted to drag on the sledge. The others experimented with various means of transporting the blade. They tried Inchgower's tongs, but there was only one pair. Regular human muscles couldn't muster anywhere near enough leverage to lift the blade, and the metal tongs couldn't get enough traction on the metal blade to effectively drag it. Besides, they'd been told they would need the blade to be in good condition when they got to the chasm of certain doom. They tried suspending the blade from loops of rope, which turned out to be a fairly effective means of cutting rope into small chunks. They tried wrapping the blade in rags, and discovered that rags were easier to cut than ropes. In a moment of desperation, they discussed rolling the blade, propelling it with a stick, like a kid in the background in an episode of Little House on the Prairie. That idea was scrapped because the twist in the blade would make it lurch unpredictably, and because the idea was insane to begin with. They decided to get some sleep, hoping a better idea would occur to them by morning. They found a place to sleep that was far enough away that Inchgower's continued reminders that their time together was at an end would not disturb them. The next morning, as Jimmy got up from his bedroll, he felt something in his hip pocket, which had been empty when he went to bed. He explored the pocket with his hand and quickly recognized that the intruder was a plastic pen with a sheet of paper wrapped around it. Jimmy looked at his fellow adventurers. Tyler and Gary were going about their business, but Philip was glancing in his direction. Jimmy made eye contact with Philip and slowly withdrew his hand from his pocket. Philip seemed satisfied and went back to putting his bedding away. After an interval of time, Jimmy had calculated to not be suspicious. He announced that he was going to go void his bowels. He didn't usually proclaim his intent to defecate so proudly, but he figured it was the most effective way possible to ensure that Todd would not want to watch him. Once he was out in the woods alone, Jimmy unrolled the note.
This is good, he thought. Philip wants to conspire, and he came to me. That shows some trust. I'm making progress.
He still held the note close to his chest and made an effort to conceal his actions in case he had misjudged Todd's proclivities. Jimmy read,
Todd is probably watching and listening. After we make the weapon, next stop is Chasm of Certain Doom. We need a plan. T.
Agreed. Ideas? P.
My first idea was to ask you. That was a dead end. Second idea, ask Gary? T.
T. No need for snark. G. How about it? Any ideas? P.
You two want a sneaky plan and you haven't asked Jay? Dumb. G.
J. P.
Jimmy shook his head as he rolled the note around the pen and stowed them both in his pocket. The wizards gathered as much water as they could, compared ideas as to how to transport the blade, and agreed that the best method they had was carefully, with lots of rags wrapped around their hands, while shouting instructions and insults at each other. They also agreed that this was a bitter disappointment. They followed the path out of town, which was not marked, but there were only two paths in or out of town, so they chose the path that had not brought them in. The path was wide, more of a road, really, and was mostly downhill, but the going was slow, and they rotated their place in formation often. They positioned the blade so that the twisted portion was at the front, so whoever carried that portion could support it with one hand while walking almost fully forward, watching the path ahead for obstacles and wolves. The two supporting the sides of the blade walked sideways, more to control the blade than to support its weight. The man at the back had the easiest job, in that he got to walk straight ahead, but he also had the most dangerous job. His view of the path was obscured by the blade and his fellow blade carriers, and if there was a mishap, the others might lose a finger, while he could very well get decapitated or cut in half. It did not take long for the lush forest, with its evergreen trees, thick undergrowth, and abundant tree wolves, to start thinning. They knew soon it would give way to some form of desert, which meant a bleak landscape, no shade, and, they'd been warned, sand wolves.
"What was that other thing he warned us about?"
Philip asked, walking sideways, both hands supporting the shining blade. Jimmy, who was in the lead position, looked back and said,
"He called it the dreaded elemental, whatever that means."
Gary, bringing up the rear, yelped,
"Eyes forward!"
Tyler said,
"An elemental is a fairly common type of monster in fantasy stories and D&D adventures. They're supposed to be made of one of the four elements, earth, wind, fire, or water. It's almost always fire, because why wouldn't it be?"
"Maybe it'll be the fifth element," Gary said, "the supreme being."
Tyler saw the confusion on Philip's face and explained,
"It's from a movie."
Tyler affected a high-pitched voice and a foreign accent and said to Gary,
"Lilu Dallas, multipass."
He turned back to Philip and said,
"In the movie, the fifth element was a beautiful woman who wore nothing but suspenders and an ace bandage. We will not be so lucky."
Philip said,
"Marvelous. What else do we know about it?"
Jimmy glanced back.
"He said the dreaded elemental, so we know that it's an elemental, and we know that it is dreaded."
"Eyes forward!"
Gary shouted.
"The dreaded elemental,"
Philip said bitterly.
"Doesn't tell us much. We already know it's dreaded. We're the ones dreading it."
Jimmy shouted back without turning his head.
"Sorry I keep turning around, Gary. I'm not doing it on purpose."
Gary said,
"Yeah, I know. Just try to remember, okay? Seriously, guys, I don't know how much of this I can take."
Philip thought,
"I don't know how much of this any of us will be able to take. I just wish there had been a better way to carry this cursed thing. Of course there wasn't, though. Todd's too clever for that."
Philip mulled that last part over a bit.
"Todd's too clever. That doesn't sound right. Maybe..."
He considered suggesting that they put the blade down and run back to town to see if there was something they had overlooked, but dismissed the thought.
"No, if there'd been something there we could have used, we'd have remembered it. We're too smart to have missed anything."
Philip mulled that over and thought,
"Ew, that doesn't sound quite right either."